despite the cooling properties of the black single suit. She took a long sniff. The parched landscape smelled dead with all the vegetation and soil gone. This desert band was dry enough for sandworms to grow, though it had not yet achieved the flinty, sterile cleanness of the real desert on Lost Rakkas. Taking a lift tube to the top of the station tower, Belanda and Doria entered the reinforced observatory. In the distance, they could see a small spice harvesting operation where a mixed crew of men and women worked a vein of rust-colored sand. Doria used a high-powered viewing scope to gaze out over the dunes. Worm sign. Through her own scope, Belanda watched a mound in motion just beneath the sand. Judging from the size of the moving ripple, the worm was small, only 5 meters or so. Farther out in the dune sea, she spotted another small sand dweller churning in toward the spice operations. These new generation worms did not yet have the power and ferocity to mark out their territories. Larger worms will create more melange, Belanda said. In a few years, our specimens may pose a genuine danger to the spice crews. We may have to institute the more expensive hovering harvesters. Updating charts on her handheld data screen, Doria said, soon we will be able to export large enough quantities of spice to make ourselves rich. We can buy all the new equipment we like. The purpose of the spice is to increase the power of our new sisterhood, not to line your pockets. What good is wealth if none of us survives the enemy? Given enough spice, we can build a powerful army. Doria shot her a hard glare. You parrot the Mother Commander so well. Gazing through the angled windows toward the faint shadows of forests smothered beneath the sand, Doria shielded her eyes against the glare. Such devastation. When Honored Matres did a similar thing to your planets with their obliterators, you called it senseless destruction. Yet on your own planet, you sisters take pride in it. Transformation is often a messy business, and not everyone sees the end result as a good thing. It is a matter of perspective and intelligence. Evil can be detected by its smell. Paul Muad'Dib, the original. Crone received regular reports on the child Baron's progress from his many face dancers in Bandalong. At first, he had asked for the creation of the Gola out of mere curiosity, but by the time the baby was 2, he had developed plans to make use of it. Face dancer plans. Baron Vladimir Harkonnen. What an interesting choice. Even he didn't know why the old masters had preserved the cells of the ancient, deviously brilliant villain. But Crone had come up with his own ideas for the Gola. First, though, the child must be raised and analyzed for special talents. It would be another decade or so before the latent memories of the Baron's first life could be triggered. That would be another assignment for Uxtal, if the little man could possibly keep himself from getting killed for that long. So many of the components in his overall scheme had interlocked over decades, even centuries. Crone could see how those pieces fit together, like the thoughts of the face dancer myriad. He could discern the smaller patterns and larger ones, and during each step he played his appropriate part. No one else on the great stage of the universe, not the audience, not the directors, not his fellow cast members, knew the extent to which the face dancers controlled the whole operation. Content that all was under control in Bandalong, Crone slipped away to Ix for his next important opportunity there. After the prized Vladimir Harkonnen Gola was born, hapless Uxtal's first difficult task was complete. Still, his oppression did not end. The simpering lost Tleilaxu researcher had not disappointed the face dancers. Even more surprising, Uxtal had managed to keep himself alive among the honored Matres for nearly 3 years now. He had marked off every single day on the makeshift calendar in his quarters. He lived in terror, and he always felt cold. He could barely sleep at night, shuddering, alert for any stalking noise, dreading the appearance of any honored Matre who might come to make good on the threat to sexually bond him. He looked under his bed for any face dancers that might be hiding there. He was the only one of his kind still alive. All the lost Tleilaxu elders had been replaced by face dancers. All the old masters murdered outright by the honored Matres. And he, Uxtal, was still breathing, which was more than he could say about any of those others. Even so, he was utterly miserable. Uxtal wished the face dancers would just take the diminutive Vladimir away. Why didn't they relieve him of at least one impossible burden? How long was Uxtal supposed to be responsible for the brat? What more did they want? More and more and more. One of these days he was sure to make a fatal error. He couldn't believe he had pulled it off for so long. Uxtal wanted to shout at the honored Matres, at any person he encountered, hoping it might be a face dancer in disguise. How could he do his work? But he simply kept his eyes averted and tried to put on a convincing show that he was working extremely hard. Being miserable was far preferable to being dead. Still alive. But how to remain that way? Did even the Matre Superior know how many shapeshifters lived among her people? He doubted it. Crone probably had insidious plans of his own. Maybe if Uxtal uncovered them and exposed the face dancer schemes to the honored Matres, then Helica would be indebted to him, would reward him. He knew, however, that would never happen. Sometimes Matre Superior Helica brought visitors into the torture laboratory, preening honored Matres, who apparently ruled other worlds that still resisted the new sisterhood's attempts to assimilate them. Helica sold them the orange drug that Uxtal now produced in great quantities. Over the years, he had perfected the technique of harvesting their adrenaline and catecholamine neurotransmitters, dopamine and endorphins, a cocktail used as the precursor for the orange spice substitute. In a superior tone, Helica explained, "We are honored Matres, not slaves to melange. Our version of spice comes as a direct consequence of pain." She and the observers looked down at the writhing subject. "It is more suited to our needs." The pretender queen bragged, as she often did, about her lab programs, exaggerating the truth by increments, much as Uxtal overemphasized his own questionable skills. As she told her lies, he always nodded in agreement with her. Since his work producing the melange substitute had expanded, he now supervised a dozen lower-caste laboratory assistants, along with a leathery, long-in-the-tooth honored Matre named Ingva, whom he was sure served more as a spy and snitch than a helper. He rarely asked the crone to do anything, because she constantly feigned ignorance or offered some other excuse. She resented taking instructions from any male, and he was afraid to make demands. Ingva came and went at unpredictable times, undoubtedly to keep Uxtal off balance. More than once, overdosed on some intoxicant, she had pounded on his door in the middle of the night. Since the Matre Superior had never claimed him for herself, Ingva threatened to bond him to her sexually, but hesitated to openly defy Helica. Looming over him in the dimness, the old honored Matre ranted threats that chilled him to the bone. Once, when she had consumed too much artificial spice stolen from the fresh laboratory supplies, Ingva had actually been near death, her delirious eyes completely orange, her vital signs weak. Uxtal had very badly wanted to let her die in front of him, but he was afraid to do so. Losing Ingva would not have solved his problems. It would have cast suspicion on him, with unknown and terrifying repercussions. And the next honored Matre spy might be even worse. Thinking quickly, he had given her an antidote that revived her. Ingva had never thanked him for the rescue, never acknowledged any debt whatsoever. Then again, she had not killed him either, or bonded with him. That was something, at least. Still alive. I am still alive. As he grew, the child Gola of Vladimir Harkonnen lived in a guarded nursery chamber on the laboratory grounds. The toddler had virtually everything he asked for, including pets to play with, many of which did not survive. Obviously, the Baron had bred true. His mean streak greatly amused Helica, even when he turned his nascent rage against her. Uxtal didn't understand why the Matre Superior paid attention to the Gola boy, or why she cared about the incomprehensible face dancer plans. The little researcher was uneasy about leaving Helica alone with the child, sure that she would harm him in some way, thus leaving Uxtal to suffer severe punishment. But he had no way of preventing her from doing anything she pleased. If he made so much as a peep of complaint, she could wither him with a glare. Fortunately, she actually seemed to like the little monster. She treated her interactions with the boy as a game. Over at the neighboring Slig farm, they happily fed human body parts to the large, slow-moving creatures that chewed the flesh into paste, which their multiple stomachs digested. After seeing the cruel streak already manifesting itself in the toddler Vladimir, Uxtal was glad the remaining cells in the dead master's hidden null entropy capsule had been destroyed. What other beasts had the heretic old Tleilaxu hoarded from ancient times? The origins of the Spacing Guild are shrouded in cosmic mists, not unlike the convoluted pathways a navigator must travel. Archives of the Old Empire. Not even the most experienced guild navigator could begin to comprehend this altered, nonsensical universe where reality held its mysteries close to its chest. But the Oracle of Time had summoned Edric and his many fellows here. Agitated, the navigator swam in his tank of spice gas atop the immense highliner, peering anxiously through the windows of his chamber into the landscapes of space and his inner mind. Around him, as far as he could see and imagine, he beheld thousands of enormous guild ships. Such a grouping had not been assembled for millennia. Following their summons to an unremarkable set of coordinates between star systems, Edric and his fellow navigators had waited for the otherworldly voice to provide further instructions. Then, unexpectedly, the fabric of the universe had folded around them and cast all of them into this vast and deeper void, with no apparent way back out. Perhaps the Oracle knew of their desperate need for spice, because Chapter House kept a stranglehold on supplies to punish the Guild for cooperating with the honored Matres. The vile Mother Commander, flaunting her power yet ignorant of how much damage she could truly cause, had threatened to destroy the spice sands if she didn't get her way. Madness. Perhaps the Oracle herself would show them another source of melange. The guild's stockpiles dwindled daily as navigators consumed what they needed in order to guide ships through folded space. Edric did not know how much spice remained in their numerous hidden storage bunkers, but Administrator Goris and his ilk were definitely nervous. Goris had already requested a meeting on Ix, and Edric would accompany him there in a matter of days. The human administrators hoped that the Ixians could create or at least improve a technological means to circumvent the shortage of melange. More nonsense. Like a breath of fresh, rich spice gas, Edric sensed something rising from the depths of his mind, filling his consciousness. A tiny point of sound expanded from within, growing louder and louder. When it finally emerged as words in his mutated brain, he heard them simultaneously thousands of times over, overlapping with the prescient minds of other navigators. The Oracle. Her mind was unimaginably advanced, beyond any level even a navigator's prescience could attain. The Oracle was the ancient foundation of the Guild, a comforting anchor for all navigators. "This altered universe is where I last saw the No-Ship piloted by Duncan Idaho. I helped his ship break free, returning him to normal space. But I have lost them again. Because the hunters continue to search for them with their tachyon net, we must find the ship first. Kralazek is indeed upon us, and the ultimate Kwisatz Haderach is aboard that No-Ship. Both sides in the Great War want him for their victory." The echoes of her thoughts filled Edric's soul with a cold terror that threatened to unwind him. He had heard legends of Kralazek, the battle at the end of the universe, and had dismissed them as no more than human superstitions. But if the Oracle was concerned about it, who was Duncan Idaho? What No-Ship was she speaking of? And, most amazing of all, how could even the Oracle be blinded to it? Always in the past, her voice had been a reassuring and guiding force. Now Edric sensed uncertainty in her mind. "I have searched, but I cannot find it. It is a tangle through all the prescient lines I can envision. My navigators, I must make you aware. I may be forced to call upon you for assistance if this threat is what I think it is." Edric's mind reeled. He felt the dismay of the navigators around him. Some of them, unable to process this new information that shook their fragile holds on reality, spun into madness within their tanks of spice gas. "The threat, Oracle," Edric said, "is that we have no melange. The threat is Kralazek." Her voice boomed through every navigator's mind. "I will summon you when I require my navigators." With a lurch, she hurled all of the thousands of great highliners back out of the strange universe, scattering them into normal space. Edric reeled, trying to orient himself and his ship. The navigators were all confused and agitated. Despite the Oracle's call, Edric clung to a far more selfish concern. "How can we help the Oracle if we are all starved for spice?" The young reed dies so easily. Beginnings are times of such great peril. Lady Jessica Atreides, the original. It was a royal birth, but without any of the customary pomp and circumstance. Had this occurred at another time, on faraway Rakkas, fanatics would have run through the streets shouting, "Paul Atreides is reborn! Muad'Dib! Muad'Dib!" Duncan Idaho could remember such fervor. When the original Jessica gave birth to the original Paul, it was a time of political intrigues, assassinations, and conspiracies that resulted in the death of Lady Honorule, wife of Emperor Shaddam IV, and the near murder of the baby. According to legend, all the sandworms on Arrakis had raised above the dunes to herald the arrival of Muad'Dib. The Bene Gesserit had never been beyond manipulating the masses with trumpets and omens and delirious celebrations about prophecies come true. Now, however, the decanting of the first of the Golas from history seemed utterly mundane, more like a laboratory exercise than a religious experience. Yet this was not just any baby, and not merely a Gola, but Paul Atreides. Young Master Paul, who was later the Emperor Muad'Dib and then the blind preacher. What would the child become this time? What would the Bene Gesserit force him to become? While waiting for the completion of the decanting process, Duncan turned to Shiana. He saw satisfaction in her eyes and uneasiness as well, though this was exactly what she had argued for. He was fully aware of what the Bene Gesserit feared. Paul had the potential in his bloodline. Almost certainly he could become the Kwisatz Haderach again, perhaps with even greater powers than before. Did Shiana and her Bene Gesserit followers hope to control him better this time? Or would it be a disaster of even greater proportions? On the other hand, what if Paul was the one who could save them from the outside enemy? The Sisterhood had played their breeding games to create a Kwisatz Haderach in the first place, and in return Paul had stung them terribly. Since Muad'Dib and the long and terrible reign of Leto II, himself another Kwisatz Haderach, the Bene Gesserit had been terrified of creating such a one again. Many fearful reverend mothers saw hints of the Kwisatz Haderach in any remarkable skill, even in precocious Duncan, Idaho. 11 previous Duncan Golas had been killed as children, and some of the proctors had made no secret of the fact that they wanted to kill him as well. To Duncan, the very idea that he might fit the mold of a messiah, like Paul, was absurd. When the Bene Gesserit Sukh doctors held up the infant, Duncan caught his breath. After cleaning sticky fluids from the fresh skin, the somber doctors subjected the baby to numerous tests and analyses, then wrapped him in sterile thermal cloths. "He is intact, undamaged," one of them reported. "A successful experiment." Duncan frowned. An experiment? Was that how they saw this? He could not tear his gaze away. A veil of memories about young Paul nearly blinded him. How he and Gurney had taught the boy his first sword and shield lessons. How during the Duke's War of Assassins, Duncan had taken the boy off to hide among the Caladan primitives. How the family had moved from their ancestral home to Arrakis and into a trap set by the Harkonnens. But he felt more than that. Looking at the healthy infant, he tried to see the face of the great Emperor Muad'Dib. Duncan knew the special pain and doubts this Gola child would experience. The Gola Paul would know about his past life, but would remember none of it, at least not for years. Taking the infant Paul into her arms, Shiana spoke quietly. "To the Fremen, he was the Messiah who came to lead them to victory. To the Bene Gesserit, he was a superhuman who emerged under the wrong circumstances and escaped our control." "He is a baby," the old rabbi said, "an unnatural one." The rabbi, himself trained as a Sukh doctor, attended the birth, though only reluctantly. He had a pronounced aversion to the tanks, but he looked somewhat defeated. With his brow furrowed and his eyes troubled, he had mumbled to Duncan, I feel duty-bound to be here. I made a promise to watch over Rebecca. The woman was all but unrecognizable on the med center table, hooked up to tubes and pumps. Was she dreaming of her other lives? Lost in a sea of ancient memories? The old man seemed to see something of his personal failure in her sagging face. Before the Bene Gesserit doctors had extracted the child from the augmented womb, he prayed for Rebecca's soul. Duncan focused on the baby. Long ago, I gave my life to save Paul. Would the universe have been better off if he had died that day under Sardaukar knives? Many sisters would make that argument. Humanity has been recovering for millennia from how he and his son changed the universe, Shiana said. But now we have a chance to raise him properly and see what he can do against the enemy. Even if he changes the universe again? Change is preferable to extinction. Master Paul's second chance, Duncan thought. He reached down with a strong hand, a sword master's hand, to touch the baby's tiny cheek. If a miracle was created by technology, was it still a miracle? The infant smelled of medicinals, disinfectants, and melange that had been added to the surrogate mother's vat for months, a precise mixture that old Cytale had told them was necessary. The baby's eyes seemed to focus on Duncan for a moment, though such a young infant could not possibly see clearly. But who could say what a Kwisatz Haderach might or might not see? Paul had foreseen the future of humankind after journeying in his mind to a place others could not go. Like magi, three Bene Gesserit Sukh doctors crowded closer, chattering with awe over the baby they had worked so hard to create. In disgust, the rabbi turned and swept past Duncan, heading for the med center's door, muttering, "Abomination," before he slipped out into the corridor. Behind him, the Bene Gesserit doctors adjusted their life support machinery and announced that the now deflated axolotl tank was ready to be impregnated with another Gola baby from the Tliloxu master's stored cells. When one has an obvious need, one has an obvious weakness. Take care when you make a request, for in doing so you reveal your vulnerabilities. Crone, private communique to his face dancer operatives. For millennia, the Ixians had managed to deliver miracles, providing what no one else could, and they rarely failed to live up to expectations. The Spacing Guild had no choice but to go to Ix when they needed an unorthodox solution for the melange shortage. The technocrats and fabricators on Ix continued their industrious research, pushing technological boundaries with their inventions. During the chaos of the scattering, Ixians had achieved significant progress in developing machines that had previously been considered taboo because of ancient restrictions imposed in the wake of the Butlerian Jihad. By purchasing devices that were suspiciously close to thinking machines, the customers themselves became complicit in breaking the age-old laws. In this atmosphere, it was in the interest of everyone to maintain complete discretion. When the desperate guild delegation arrived on Ix, members of the Face Dancer Myriad were everywhere in secret. Posing as an Ixian engineer, Crone attended the meeting. Another step in a dance so well choreographed that the participants could not see their own movements. The new sisterhood and the guild would dig their own graves, and Crone considered that a good thing. The guild representatives were ushered into one of the giant underground manufactories where copper shielding and scan scramblers concealed them from view. No one would ever know this group had come here except for the Ixians and the Face Dancers. After decades of infiltration, Crone and his improved shapeshifters easily fit in. They looked exactly like scientists, engineers, and fast-talking bureaucrats. Now, filling his role as a skilled deputy fabricator, Crone wore short brown hair and a heavy brow. The lines around his mouth indicated that here was a hard-working functionary, someone whose opinion could be trusted and whose conclusions would stand up to any amount of double-checking. Three others in the largely silent assembly were also Face Dancers, but the spokesman for the Ixians was, for the time being at least, a true human. So far, Chief Fabricator Shyama Sen had given them no reason to replace him. Sen seemed to want the same things Crone did. Ixians and Face Dancers shared a barely concealed disdain for foolish fears and fanaticism. Was it truly an invasion and a conquest, Crone wondered, if the Ixians would have accepted the new order anyway? Inside the immense hall, the air was filled with the hissing of production lines, vaporous plumes of cold baths, and the acrid fluids of imprinting chemicals. Others might have found the clamor of sights, sounds, and smells distracting, but the Ixians considered it soothing white noise. Edric, the navigator's armored tank, drifted on suspensors, flanked by four gray-clad escorts. Crone knew that the navigator would be the greatest problem here, for his faction had the most to lose. But the mutated creature did not take charge of the negotiations. That task was left to the sharp-eyed guild spokesman, Rentel Goris, who stepped forward on willowy legs. His long white braid hung rope-like from his otherwise bald scalp. The visitors covered themselves with a veneer of importance and entitlement, which revealed a great deal about the extent of their anxiety. True confidence was quiet and invisible. "The Spacing Guild has needs," said Administrator Goris, sweeping the room with his milky but not blind eyes. "If Ix can fulfill them, we are willing to pay any reasonable price. Find us a way out of the manacles the new sisterhood has placed on us." Shyama Sen folded his hands together and smiled. "And what is it you need?" The nails on his two forefingers were metallic and patterned with the kaleidoscopic lines of circuitry. Edric swam close to the speaker in his thick-walled tank. "The guild needs spice so that we may guide our ships. Can Ix's machinery create melange? I see no point in coming here." Goris gave the navigator a glare of pure annoyance. "I am not so skeptical. The Spacing Guild wonders if Ixian technology could be used regularly and reliably for navigation, at least during this difficult transition period. Since the time of the God Emperor, Ix has produced certain calculating machines that can take the place of navigators. Only in part. The machines have always been inferior," Edric said. "Poor copies of a real navigator. Nevertheless, they proved useful in times of great need," Shyama Sen pointed out. "During the various waves of scatterings, many ships used the primitive devices to travel without the benefit of spice or navigators. And a vast number of those ships were lost," Edric interrupted. "We will never know how many blundered through suns or dense nebulae. We will never know how many were simply lost, arriving in unknown star systems and unidentified worlds, never able to find their way back. Recently, when melange was plentiful, thanks to Tleilaxu tank-manufactured spice, the guild had no qualms about relying on our navigators," Administrator Goris said, sounding quite reasonable. Now, however, times have changed. If we can prove to the new sisterhood that we don't rely solely on them, then their monopoly has no teeth. Then, perhaps, they will not be so haughty and intractable, and they will be more willing to sell us spice. That remains to be proved, grumbled the navigator. Navigation devices have remained in use among certain parties, Shyama Sen added. When the honored Matres began to return from the outside fringes, they did not have navigators. Only when they needed to know the full landscape of the old empire did they rely upon the services of the guild. And you cooperated with them, Crone said, using his words like a needle. Is that not why the sisterhood is displeased with you? The witches also used their own ships, bypassing the guild, Goris said in a huff. Until recently. They did not trust us even with the coordinates of Chapter House, fearing we would have sold the location to the honored Matres. And would you have? Sen seemed amused. Yes, I think so. This has nothing to do with the discussion of navigation machines. The guild administrator abruptly cut off further discussion. The chief fabricator smiled and tapped his fingernails together, unleashing a flurry of sparks along the circuit paths like tiny phosphorescent rats scurrying through a maze. Though such artificial devices were not accurate, or practical, or necessary, we still installed them in a few ships, even in recent times. Though neither guild ships nor independent vessels relied upon them, their primary purpose was to demonstrate to the Tleilaxu and the priests of the Divided God that we could indeed function without their spies. However, the plans have been shelved for many centuries. Goris continued, perhaps given sufficient monetary incentive, you could revisit that old technology and develop it to a higher level? Crone required all the control of his fluid facial muscles to keep the smile off his face. This was exactly what he had hoped for. Chief Fabricator Sen also looked extremely pleased. He examined Edric's armored tank, intrigued by its engineering. Perhaps navigators should have used their prescience to see this melange shortage coming. That is not how our prescience works. Goris pointed out, the new sisterhood is now the sole provider of melange, and their mother commander Mirbella will not yield, despite our entreaties. Edric added, we have met with her. She is not rational. It seems to me that Mirbella is perfectly aware of her power and her bargaining position, the chief fabricator said, speaking mildly. We would like to take that bargaining chip from the witches, but we can only do so with your help, said the guild administrator. Give us another option. Crone knew that adding his support would do little. However, by expressing strawman doubts, he would forge a closer alliance between these others. To develop a navigation machine of such sophistication, and to use it as more than a mere symbol, would require technology dangerously close to thinking machines. There are the restrictions of the Butlerian Jihad to consider. Sen, Goris, and even the navigator responded with scorn. The people will forget the ancient commands of the Jihad soon enough if guild ships are unable to fly, if all space travel is crippled, the administrator said. Crone turned to the chief fabricator, who was ostensibly his boss. I would be honored if Ix accepted this challenge, sir. My best teams can begin work on adapting numerical compilers and mathematical projection devices. Shyama Sen chuckled at the guildsman. The price will be high. A percentage, perhaps. The Spacing Guild and Chome are among our best customers, and our ties could grow stronger still. Chome is sure to contribute to the cost if they see that it is necessary to keep interstellar trade functioning, Goris admitted. How these guildsmen tried to hide their desperation. Krohn decided it was best to give them a different target. While the Bene Gesserits and the honored Matres were at each other's throats, the Guild and Chome continued commercial activities unmolested. Now, the new sisterhood claims that a far worse enemy is coming at them, at us, from outside. Goris made a rude snort, as if he had much to say on the subject, but swallowed his opinions like thick lumps of phlegm. The chief fabricator gazed down his nose. Is there evidence that this enemy exists at all? And is the enemy of the Sisterhood and the honored Matres necessarily the enemy of Ix, the Guild, or Chome? Trade is trade, Edric said in a bubbling voice. Everyone requires it. The Guild requires navigators, and we require spice. Or navigation machines, Goris added. Krohn nodded placidly. And thus we return to the necessary price for Ixian services. If you can produce what we ask, then our profits, and indeed the shift in the balance of power, will be of incalculable value. I believe we can make it a viable prospect for both of us. As the administrator spoke, the navigator continued to look uncomfortable. Krohn allowed the faintest of satisfied smiles on his false face. From the far distant overlords who always watched him through the tachyon net, he already had access to any navigational calculators the Guild could need. Such technology was quite basic compared to what the enemy could command. For Krohn, it would be a simple matter of pretending to develop such technology on Ix and then selling it at great cost to the Guild. Around them, the fabrication plant continued to produce the sounds and smells of vigorous industry. I still do not like the implications of technology superseding true navigators. Edric seemed trapped in his tank. Your loyalty is to the Spacing Guild, Edric, Goris brusquely reminded him. And we will do what we must to survive as an organization. We have little choice in the matter. The treatment of an injury may hurt more than the wound itself. Do not allow a sore to fester because you were unwilling to tolerate the momentary pain. Bene Gesserit Suk Dr. Floriana Nikus. Mirbella walked with Jeunesse, now Reverend Mother Jeunesse, through the stony remnants of the dying gardens around the keep. They stood by the rocky bed of a dry stream, all the moisture stolen by the dramatically changing climate of Chapter House. The polished stones were a poignant reminder of the fast-flowing water that had once rushed along this channel. You are my lieutenant now, no longer my daughter. She knew her words must sound harsh to the young woman, but Jeunesse did not flinch. Both of them understood that from now on an appropriate emotional separation had to be maintained, that Mirbella must be Mother Commander, not Mother. Both the Bene Gesserits and the honored Matres have tried to prohibit love, but they can only prohibit the expression of it, not the thought or emotion. Mother Superior Audrade was called a heretic among her sisters because she believed in the power of love. I understand, Mother. Commander. Each of us must give up something for the sake of the new order. I shall teach you to swim by hurling you into the raging waters. A metaphor that I fear will not be relevant here much longer. I am counting on you to advance more quickly than either of our factions. It has taken 6 years of struggle, dragging both sides toward the center for the women to learn to live with each other. Fundamental change may take generations, but we have made great strides. Duncan Idaho called it compromise by swordpoint, Janess quoted. Mirbella raised her eyebrows. Did he? I can show you the historical record if you like. An apt description. The new sisterhood is not yet the smoothly running machine I had hoped for, but I have convinced the sisters to stop killing each other. Most of them, at least. She thought quickly of Janessa's old nemesis, Carrie DeBrock, who had disappeared from the student bungalows only days before she'd been scheduled to undergo the agony. Carrie had renounced the conversion as brainwashing and slipped away into the night. Few of the sisters would miss her. Under normal circumstances, Mirbella continued, I could overlook the fact that some honored matres don't accept my rule. Freedom of discourse and the airing of opposing philosophies. But not now. Janess drew herself straight, showing that she was ready for her assignment. Renegade honored matres still control much of Gamu and a dozen other worlds. They have seized the Soustone operations on Boozle and gathered their most powerful forces on Tlilox. Over the past year, the Mother Commander had assembled a force of sisters and vigorously trained them in the combined fighting techniques of Honored Matres and Bene Gesserits. The bond between the two factions was best forged in the crucible of personal combat. Now, it is time to give my trainees a target. Stop training and start fighting, Janess said. Another quote from Duncan? Not that I'm aware of. But I think he'd agree with the sentiment. Mirbella smiled wryly. Yes, he probably would. If the renegades will not join us, they must be eliminated. I will not have them slip knives into our backs when we are concentrating on real battles. They have had years to entrench themselves, and they will not fall without a terrific battle. Mirbella nodded. Of more immediate concern is the enclave of dissidents right here on Chapter House. It hurts me like a splinter in my hand. In the best case, it causes troublesome pain. In the worst, it festers and spreads an infection. Either way, the splinter must be removed. Janess narrowed her eyes. Yes, they are much too close to home. Even if the Chapter House dissidents do nothing overt against us, they demonstrate a weakness to outside observers. The situation brings to mind another wise observation from Duncan Idaho's first life. In a report he submitted when he lived among the Fremen on Dune, he said, A leak in a canot is a slow but fatal weakness. Finding the leak and plugging it is a difficult task, but it must be done for the survival of all. The Mother Commander was both proud and amused. In citing so many of Duncan's writings, do not forget to think for yourself. Then someday others will begin quoting you. Her daughter wrestled with that idea, then nodded. Mirbella continued, You will help me plug the leak in the canot, Janess. The Bashar of the new sisterhood's main forces, Wiki Aztin, devoted her time and her best resources to training Janess for her first tough assignment. Wiki had a ready sense of humor and a story for every occasion. A stooped and narrow-faced woman of uncommon energy, she suffered from a congenital heart defect that prevented her from attempting the agony. Thus, Wiki had never become a reverend mother. Instead, she was assigned to the Sisterhood's military operations, where she had risen through the ranks. Outside the Mother Commander's shelter in the isolated training fields, spotlights illuminated the attack thopters Jeunesse was preparing for their vigorous assault the following day. House cleaning, Mirbella called it. These rebels had betrayed her. Unlike outsiders who had never heard the Sisterhood's teachings, or misguided women who did not know the threat of the oncoming enemy. Mirbella hated the honored Matre holdouts on Boozle, Gamu, and Tlilox, but those women didn't know any better. These dissidents, however, she considered their betrayal far worse. It was a personal affront. When Jeunesse was out of earshot, tending to her duties, Mirbella came up to stand with the Bashar. Wiki said, "Did you know that some of the sisters are betting against your pup, Mother Commander?" "I suspected as much. They feel I gave her too much responsibility too soon after becoming a reverend mother, but it's only making her work harder. I've seen her digging in with a new resolve, trying to prove them wrong. She's got your spirit, and she reveres Duncan Idaho. With all eyes on her, she looks forward to an opportunity to shine, to set an example for others." Wiki looked out into the night. "You sure you don't want me to come along on the assault tomorrow? This engagement is close to home, small but important. A real exercise would be gratifying. I need you to stay here and watch things. While I'm away from the keep, someone could attempt a coup. I thought you had gotten them to settle their differences." "It is an unstable equilibrium." Mirbella sighed. "Sometimes I wish the real enemy would just attack us and force those women to all fight on the same side." The following morning, Mirbella and her squadron took off. Jeunesse rode with her in the lead thopter as they flew over the surface of the planet. Despite her training and the confidence her mother placed in her, Jeunesse was still a green lieutenant, not yet ready to assume command. After turning a reluctant blind eye to them for several years, the Mother Commander had decided she could no longer tolerate deserters and malcontents. Even in the remote regions, the settlement was too great a weak spot, a magnet for potential saboteurs as well as a possible foothold for a larger force of renegade honored matres from elsewhere. Mirbella had no doubts about what she had to do, and no sympathy. Because the new sisterhood was desperate for competent fighters, she would invite the deserters back into the fold, but she did not have high hopes that any of them would accept. As cowards and complainers, these women had already shown their true colors. She wondered what Duncan would have done in a situation like this. As the squadron approached the reported location of the encampment, Jeunesse reported that she had picked up heat and transmission signatures. Without prompting, she ordered all of the aircraft to activate their shields in case the rebels fired at them with weapons stolen from the chapter house armories. When Jeunesse and her tactical officers scanned the area in their initial high-altitude sweep, however, they found no competing aircraft or military equipment in the vicinity, just a few hundred lightly armed women trying to hide in the thick conifer forests below. Although patches of snow made for wide variances in the thermal map of the area, the human bodies stood out like bonfires. Converting the image to optical, Mirbella panned across the deserters, many of whom she recognized. Some had been gone for years, even before she had executed one of their vocal proponents, Anine. She addressed the rebels below over the thopter's booming loudspeaker. "This is Mother Commander Mirbella, and I come offering an olive branch. We have transport thopters at the rear of our formation, ready to bring all of you back to the keep. If you disarm and cooperate, I will grant you amnesty and the opportunity for retraining." She saw Kerry de Brock on the ground. The bitter young woman pointed a Farsi rifle at them. Tiny pinpoints of fire spat out, and the fast, molten projectiles struck harmlessly against the thopter's shields. "Damn lucky it's not a laser gun," Mirbella said. Jeunesse looked astonished. "Laser guns are forbidden on Chapter House."
"Much is forbidden, but not everyone follows the rules."
Working her jaw angrily, Mirbella spoke over the loudspeaker again in a sharper tone. "You have deserted your sisters in a time of crisis. Put this divisiveness behind you and return with us. Or are you cowards, afraid to face our true enemy?" Kerry fired the Farsi rifle again, splattering more molten projectiles against the thopter's shields.
"At least we didn't fire the first shot."
Jeunesse looked at her mother. "In my opinion, Mother Commander, negotiating with them is a waste of time. With well-placed sedative darts, we could disarm them, force them back to the keep, then try to win them over." Below, many of the other rebels grabbed their weapons and shot ineffectively at the Sisterhood's assault force. Mirbella shook her head.
"We will never bring them back into the fold."
"Should we try a limited military engagement, then? Just enough to strike fear into them? It would give our new squadron practice in the field. Land the soldiers and use them to attack and humiliate the holdouts. If our hand-to-hand combat skills can't defeat this lot, we won't have a chance against the real whores who have had years to build up their planetary defenses." Seeing the malcontents firing at them with rifles, Mirbella felt increasing anger. Her voice broke like glass in her own ears.
"No. Doing so would only risk more of our loyal sisters. I won't lose a single fighter here."
She shuddered to think of how much damage these women could cause if they pretended to surrender and then spread their poison from within.
"No, Jeunesse. They have made their choice. We can never trust them again. Never again."
Her daughter's eyes flashed with understanding.
"They're no more than insects.
Shall we exterminate them?" Below, more dissidents were running through the trees and emerging from the dense pines, carrying heavier weapons. "Drop shields and open fire," Mirbella shouted into the comm system that connected all of the attack vessels. "Use incendiaries to light the woods." An officer in one of the other thopters protested that the response was too severe, but Mirbella cut her off. "There will be no debate." Her hand-picked squadron opened fire, and the blazing bloodbath left no survivors. She took no joy in it, but the Mother Commander had showed that she would strike like a scorpion if provoked. She hoped that such knowledge would prevent further discontent and opposition.
"Let this be an example that will long be remembered," she said. "An enemy among us can cause damage as surely as the enemy outside."
11 years after escape from Chapter House. Caladan, third planet of Delta Pavonis, birth world of Paul Muad'Dib. The planet was later renamed Dan. Terminology of the Imperium, revised. When the Gola of Baron Vladimir Harkonnen was 7 years old, the Face Dancers commanded Uxtal to take him to the ocean world of Dan.
Dan?
Caladan?
Why are we going there? Uxtal asked. Does this have something to do with the fact that it was once the homeworld of House Atreides, enemy of House Harkonnen? In his joy to be going away from Matre Superior Helica, the lost Tleiloxa researcher found the courage to view the Face Dancer as his rescuer. We have found something there. Something that could allow us to use the resurrected Baron. The Face Dancer escort raised a hand, stopping the question Uxtal was about to ask. That is all you need to know. While he had prayed fervently for the day when he could relinquish the difficult Gola child, Uxtal now worried that Crone might consider his usefulness to be at an end. Maybe the Face Dancers would come up behind him, place fingers over his eyes, and squeeze, as they'd done to Elder Bura. He hurried toward the shuttle that would take him and the brat away from Tleilax. He mumbled to himself like a personal mantra, I am still alive. Still alive. At least he would be away from Ingva and Helica, the stench of sligs and the screams of torture victims being wrung dry of their pain-induced chemicals. In the intervening years, Helica had continued to enjoy young Vladimir Harkonnen. They were birds of a feather. Uxtal found it chilling to hear the 7-year-old boy and the Matre Superior laugh together as they discussed people who didn't deserve to live anymore, choosing victims for the torture laboratories. The treacherous little boy reported constantly to the Pretender Queen, informing her of purported mistakes or indiscretions committed by laboratory assistants. Uxtal had lost many of his best helpers that way, and the scheming child fully comprehended.